everyone. It's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit RightRug.com. That's RiteRug.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity. It's designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals to help cover unexpected expenses, plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. In other words, it's like getting a paycheck for life. We'll say that again. A paycheck for life. Guaranteed. Sounds too good to be true? It's not. It's the Parity Flex annuity. And it's one more example of their commitment to creating a better financial future for women. One where they feel empowered, not excluded, and ready to take on whatever their next chapter holds. Gainbridge believes financial flexibility and security are things we all could use more of. At retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Who's with us? Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Please visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Oh, hi, hello there. This is Let's Talk About Myths, Baby. And I am your host, that woman who just, well, loves mythology. I am Liv. You all know how much I love my conversation episodes. It's so much fun to get to speak with people who have such specialized and fascinating knowledge, and today's episode is yet another instance of that. I spoke with Helen Lovett, who quite literally wrote the book on the Argonautica. Helen is a professor of classics at Nottingham University in the UK and joined me to talk all things Argo. I have covered that story for all of you before, even read you all the Argonautica itself, but one thing I haven't been able to dive into until this conversation is just how old and how widespread the myth of Jason and the Argonauts really is. It was known as far back as the Homeric epics, where it's referenced to having already happened, and it spanned all the way into the Roman period and far, far beyond. Jason may be one of the most boring, if not one of the most malicious, heroes, but fortunately, there is so much more to the story of the Argonautica than just Jason. This was such a fun conversation. We talked about so many different bits and pieces of the Argonautica story, from its origins all the way into some of the modern representations of it. We talked about Medea, obviously, myth broadly, sourcing, because I always want to talk about sourcing, and my not-so-new obsession with the island of Samothrace, because, well, the Argonauts went there. Conversations, a journey aboard the Argo, the many myths of the Argonautica with Helen Lovett. Argonauts. I'm really excited about this. Because obviously the Argonauts, but I find lately I've been talking to so many people about historical things that I'm thrilled when I get like an explicitly, I guess not even explicitly because there's so much history kind of around it, but these people are explicitly mythological at the very least.
Absolutely. Like myth. The cool thing about the Argonaut story is there are just so many weird versions of it. And it's completely an example of what myth is like right from the beginning.
Yeah. So, I mean, let's dive right into that. So I've covered the Argonautica story. Like typically I've been using the Apollonius, obviously, because it's like the longest, most complete one that we have. But I've also, you know, seen all those different variations. So like, how far back does it go? Like, what are the earliest kind of sourcing on these wild people looking for a golden fleece?
Yeah, well, it's sort of hard to know in that there are definitely some really early things that possibly go back to the ancient Near East. So, I mean, the Hercules story is amongst the oldest strata of myth. And there's pretty good sense from the Homeric poems that the Jason story was already really well known. So there's a little bits in the Iliad talking about the children of Jason by Hypsipyle, and there's little bits in the Odyssey where Circe talks about them going through the Wandering Rocks, and she says there's only one ship that's ever managed to do this, and that is the Argo, well known to all. So it's a story that's already well known by the time of the Odyssey, which means, you know, perhaps a lot of episodes in the Odyssey that look like episodes in the Argonautica were actually based on an earlier oral Argonautica. But it looks, because we're looking at it from the vantage point of Apollonius in the Hellenistic period, it looks like it's a much newer story, but actually it's a really old one.
That is amazing. That's my favorite thing about any time I'm encountering, like, or trying to explain, I guess, like how these stories were transmitted to people. I just did like I've been trying to get on TikTok and be young. So I just did like a TikTok video about the oral transmission of stories and that the way that happens. And this is such an amazing example. I'd forgotten how explicitly, like, I don't think I'd kind of clocked, or just it's been a long time since I've read the Iliad. But those bits. But of course, yeah, Circe makes these really explicit references to that already having happened, which is just... Sorry. Then my mind starts exploding on the like what we don't have, which is the story of everything.
So much. Yeah. And there's loads. There were lots of foundation epics from the sort of 6th, 5th century BC that like there were ones from the Corinthian area because Corinth was quite strongly associated with the Argonaut myth. And sometimes Aeetes, the bad guy in Colchis, is also Corinthian and has a claim on the Corinthian throne, which is one of the reasons why Jason and Medea go there. So there's all this stuff associated with different places in Greece as well. So there's just loads of, and then the visual and material culture stuff as well.
One of the things that just occurred to me, but I've been really deep in talking and thinking about Thebes lately. And one of my favorite connections between those two things is this idea that like, Cadmus goes and founds Thebes, he kills the dragon, he sews the dragon teeth, and some of those dragon teeth don't get sewn there in Thebes, and they get like eventually given off to Aeetes. And that's just so like specific and interesting. And do you have any thoughts on like where that connection might have come in?
It's an interesting one, isn't it? I mean, so this is from Apollonius. So, and Apollonius is such a playful author. So he's so self-aware in the way he takes alternative mythical traditions and puts them next to each other or reworks them or uses alternative versions or makes little references back to them without actually telling the audience he's doing it. And like, it would work really well if he was also working with a sort of Thebaid tradition that he was sort of playing around with and developing in his own way. And then he's sort of saying, well, look, you know, I took the seeds from somewhere else. and of course, one of the key versions before Apollonius is Pindar Pythian IV. And Pindar was like in a Theban context. Mm-hmm. So you can really think about it as it might well have been an established part of the tradition, but it also works really well as one of these little poetic games where they're playing around with how the different bits of story relate to each other.
Yeah. One of the other interesting things that I've come across but haven't looked into too much detail, but is like the variations on who was on that ship.
Oh my God, so many. I made a spreadsheet.
Oh God.
I'm not normally a big spreadsheet person, but I just felt it was necessary. So I have like 107 different Argonauts on my spreadsheet. But I go all the way, because the book I was writing was a study of the tradition right from the beginnings up to the present day. So it's got things like the Argonaut board game.
And the
Argonaut deck of cards and things like that in it. Computer games and so on. But it was really interesting to see how people like to pick the like coolest, most recognizable names. Mm-hmm. But then almost every version would also add in some random guy that they invented.
It's interesting.
So like the 1963 film, for instance, has Spiros, the amazing swimmer.
Oh God, right. Yeah, yeah. So Atalanta is the one that always occurs to me, because like I don't think we have much in the way of details of her being there, but sometimes she's there, right?
So she's there in Apollodorus.
Oh, she is. Okay. Oh,
yeah. So Apollodorus is because he's a sort of handbook of lots of different versions, and so there's a reasonable chance that there was quite an early version in which Atalanta was one of the Argonauts, and also there's quite a strong set of connections between the Caledonian boar hunt and the Argonaut sort of crew, in that a lot of the Argonaut crew were involved in the boar hunt, and that's obviously something she's always involved in. Mm-hmm. So when Apollonia says, "We cannot have any woman on this ship, it would make a mess," that's another one of those things where he's saying, in other versions they include Atalanta, but I am not going to, because I am super misogynist. But although he sort of is and sort of isn't.
I was going to say, yeah, so I started reading that because I've like covered the story, and then I actually did like a full reading of, like, it was an old translation because I have to do public domain, like copyright free translations to read them. But I did this full reading series on the show where I read the whole of the Argonautica, and I kind of went into it thinking like, okay, there's no women. He's making a whole point of it. Like, there's not a lot going on. But then when you get to Medea, like,
she's a very cool character.
Yes, his version of Medea is very cool in a way that I was not expecting. Reading it into my microphone, being like, wow.
She's very heroic. She's very much like a Homeric hero. Mm-hmm. She has a sort of authority and power. And also I feel like he's part of a long sequence of people who were, you know, pissed off with Euripides.
You think so?
Yeah. A lot of people like get really drawn into Euripides' Medea and mm-hmm. want to sort of understand where she came from. And so it's a sort of the rehabilitation, but also the foreshadowing. So right. Showing this innocent, idealized, but still powerful and witchy character.
Yeah, that makes sense. I love Euripides' version of her, obviously. But yeah, I mean, if you're trying to like wrap your head around that one, which is so, like, we don't really have much in the way before Euripides of her. We just know that she was a thing. But that his version too, I love like how explicit he is. This is like Apollonius, I mean, how explicit he is that like she is under a love spell. Like this is not her actions, in a way that I felt very vindicating.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting one, isn't it? And my students always get really obsessed about this because they can't get their head around it, and they want to blame. But there's definitely a sort of double causation that happens in epic where it's both fate and the actions of the people. And I'm actually just listening to Emily Wilson's Odyssey at the moment as a sort of therapeutic act. And I just heard the bit while I was on the tram the other day where Odysseus says, well, you know, fate has brought them to their end, the suitors, but their own, you know, and their own actions. So it's a really clear expression of that double causation.
Well, I always try to explain it too to my listeners of like, yeah, it's both, but it's also like the two in this context are so interlinked that you almost like can't separate them. Like it's how I try to describe, and this fits perfectly too, but like the idea of love. It's like love is Aphrodite. Aphrodite inflicts love, but also your love is real because Aphrodite has inflicted your love. So it's like, it's fate. It's always going to happen, but also it's real. Like, because there is no alternative. You can't form it explicitly on your own. Like, she has to do it in a way that, So I think that's how I kind of...
The god is both the personification of the psychological phenomenon and a character, an anthropomorphic character that has plans and designs of their own. And that all of those things are happening at the same time. So
exactly, yeah. Like, it's just, you can't have one without the other, so you can't blame one and not the other. Like, they're just working together in that so explicit way.
It's interesting because in Pindar, it's Jason who uses the spell to enchant Medea. Oh, so he gets Aphrodite's help to design this sort of magical thing called a yunx, which involves a bird. And we don't really know how it works, but some sort of magic spell, some sort of love spell. And he basically makes her fall in love. So he's got a lot more agency in Pindar's version, whereas in Apollonius, he's a lot more sort of hapless and passive.
Yeah. I haven't read enough Pindar. I don't know why. Well, I guess I do know why, is that so much of it is tied into, like, just talking about people who won games. And so I have trouble.
Oh, but it's so gorgeous as well.
Oh, like, I know. It's beautiful. But for me, I have to turn that into a story for my listeners. And so translating that into, like, a story that I'm not just reading Pindar to them. Like, if I could just read it aloud, then I would, you know, it's one of those. That's my struggle constantly. But that is really interesting.
I think Pythian 4 is a really nice way into Pindar because it's his longest one and one of his most narrative.
Okay.
And it does, although it's, and the frame is quite an obvious and interesting story in itself, in that the man who commissioned it was exiled from Cyrene. And you've got these clear parallels where he's trying to basically persuade the king not to act like a tyrant and take him back. But so it's this idea of positive kingship runs through it, and also of healing social divisions. So you've got Medea in there as a prophet figure talking about the foundation of Cyrene, which is usually very at the very end of the Argo's voyage. And it's a sort of, it sort of folds in on itself. It's really narrative, very complex narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's, and then he obviously stops at the key moment of killing the dragon because he's maximum annoying guy.
I like that. That was what surprised me in finishing the Argonautica too, is that it stopped before I imagined it would. Because of everything else I've read. I was like, what? You're not even going to get back to Greece? What's happening?
Nope.
We're like, you know.
We just did this water carrying thing and it was fun, and then we got back. Bye.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, thanks, bye.
That's it. What is happening?
But that's very Apollonius, because you know, his in the Hellenistic period they were sort of experimenting with poetic form and just, you know, overturning and undermining all the ways everything worked before. Mm-hmm. So he's just having a lot of fun with the epic genre. And that's in a way what the deep dive into Medea's characterization is part of, that because you're not supposed to spend an entire book with a lovesick princess.
No, I would imagine not in that time. Yeah, that's it always fascinates me too, to specifically look at things like Apollonius compared to the earlier epics, because it's such an interesting difference to see something that was written so intentionally versus compiled over an oral tradition. You know, like, he went in with a point of what he wanted to write, which is something that we don't often have, or certainly we don't for the Iliad and the Odyssey. And then so, like, looking at those decisions as actual choices being made versus just like the result of a tradition is...
Yeah, it's actually quite hard to know what degree of authorial intention you can envisage for the Iliad or the Odyssey, because
exactly
at some point someone decided what to include. But a lot of that was going on, you know, maybe in the editing process at the time when Apollonius was writing.
There's just so many versions. So before I jump into also wanting to hear your thoughts on the Orphic one, which I have not read any of, I just know it exists, but I'm curious about, like, locations within it and what those say about, I mean, I guess the time, like what was going on, like what is there in the really specific, like, stops they make along the way? Because a lot of the time they feel really, they can be like really brief and seem like they have no point at all, or they can be like really extensive and you're like, why have you spent so much time, you know, explaining this thing? I'm mm-hmm. so curious about them.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things Apollonius is participating in is the Hellenistic interest in travel narrative. Mm. So he gives a lot of detail about the, you know, the specific rivers and what it's like to, and there's a brilliant experimental archaeology book by Tim Severin, the guy who did all those cool voyages, which was part of a 1980s TV series, where he takes Apollonius and uses it to sort of reconstruct what an actual voyage was like with a reconstructed Mycenaean boat. And he really looks at, say, the description of the clashing rocks and compares it to the currents in the Bosphorus. And it's really, really interesting and persuasive in the sort of level of detail that Apollonius gives about the landscape. He's clearly, you know, really fascinated by the geographical realities.
Mm-hmm.
There's that. And then there's also the Hellenistic obsession with aetiology, so telling stories about how things happened and foundation stories. And also... the interest in sort of the wider Greek world and colonizing other areas like the Black Sea.
Mm-hmm.
So quite a lot of the places that they stop at then later on reinvent themselves as sort of Argonaut town.
Right.
And it's all over. I mean, so, you know, because the return journey, there's so many different versions of it. Pretty much anywhere could claim to have had the Argonauts go through mm-hmm. on the way back. Like Ljubljana has a big Argonaut tradition.
Interesting. That just made you realize too that there's a tradition, and I'm not remembering if it's in Apollonius or not, but where they stop on Samothrace, which is,
yeah, that's in Apollonius.
My obsession. It is. Okay.
Yeah, I love Samothrace. Oh,
it's
so cool.
I went there in June, and my life has never been the same. And now I don't think about anything else. And so I bring it up every time I talk to anyone in case I can connect it. But this is such a distinct connection because they go there. And is it in Apollonius, or I don't know if it's just a tradition of that time, but like they're inducted into the mystery too.
Yeah. He doesn't say very much about it. He just says that Orpheus told them to go there and they did it. And then after that, they were much safer. But I think it probably comes from Aeschylus Kebeiroi, which is only fragmentary, which is the Kebeiroi were the gods on Samothrace. So that the initiation rite seems to have been the central aspect of that, and it's the Argonauts who do it.
Mm-hmm.
So that seems to be quite an old part of the story as well.
Why did I not know that Aeschylus wrote about them? Okay, sorry, I'm taking mental notes myself.
I know about that because of Emma Cole's awesome article about Punch Drunk's immersive theatre, where they were doing that, they did a version of the Kebeiroi in London where people like walked around London being initiated into things and had to go into the British Museum and look at artifacts and then ended up in a warehouse. And oh my God, it sounds so cool.
My brain is exploding.
Immersive theatre. Oh.
London has so many of those right now because there's
the Bird
that
City.
One. Yes. So many people have told me about it. And they're like, you have to do it. I'm like, did you think it's easy for me to get to London? I live in the Pacific Northwest.
Oh, yeah.
I really wanted
to go, but I'm too blind. Because it would involve a lot of hanging out in the dark and falling over things.
Right.
And I just don't think I could do it.
No, but, that's fair. Oh, yeah. I've had a bunch of people tell me about it. I'm like, I've heard. I can't go. Oh, my gosh. But that's amazing. Yeah. The Samothrace of it. Well, I never know what to call it, but I'm going to call it Samothrace. But when I'm in Greece,
it doesn't matter. I guess I went there. So when I was in Greece, it was Samothrace.
I know. It's exactly how I do it. Even I'll be talking to people in Victoria and I'll switch between the two and they're like, what are you? I'm like, sorry, I did learn that I cannot say Samothrace over there. They do need me to say Samothrace and I don't blame them. And I will. Yeah, I know. It's become a complete obsession. I'm already thinking about like when I could go back there, but it's so beautiful. It reminded me like both of where I come from and like not at all in these really interesting ways. Like Therma is like basically home in a way that I was like, I was not expecting this. And it's just wild. Yeah. No, I spent 2 weeks there alone in June. And now I'm just thinking about it.
It's when my husband and I were interrailing back in 1996. We stopped there. The first place we stopped after Istanbul. And we got just like, we were just in love with it and couldn't bear to leave. So we used up so much of our interrailing ticket just sitting on Samothrace.
I mean, there is nothing wrong with that. It is unbelievable.
And it was September and empty, oh. And the weather was gorgeous, and there were stars and waterfalls.
I will stop because I don't know how much of this is going to stay in the episode of just like fawning over Sam Witwicky, but I stayed in this basically the closest place I could find to the mysteries, because that is all I've been writing a novel about Cadmus and Harmonia, and over the past year became like, oh, turns out I have to write it about Sam Witwicky, like there's no question, and so that's cool. Why I went. I don't know if I'll ever finish it, but I'm now obsessed with the island at least. But so I got like the closest place I could find to there, to the sanctuary. And I'd heard, like, for when I was there in June, so it was also empty. And I think the pandemic might have hit them harder, which I wouldn't surprise me, because like so many things were just like completely nothing. But I had a drink with one of the people working at the site, and she had talked about how she'd seen dolphins like just off the coast, like while walking on that road around the island. And I was like, I haven't seen dolphins yet. Like, I'm so disappointed. And I walked back to my hotel, and this guy had just brought in like 60 sheep to just like do their sheepy thing, like on the ground right by the water between the road and the ocean. And he was just like, I couldn't even tell where he'd come from. Like, he had like seemingly walked there with his like shepherd crook and just like hanging out with his sheep.
Yeah.
This is incredible. I don't know what I'm witnessing. Yeah. And I was so obsessed with trying to watch and see where he brought the sheep that I went back to my hotel, which could see the water. And I was like watching these sheep, and then dolphins went right behind the sheep. They were like 10
sheep and dolphins.
I was like, what is happening? This island is magical.
Arcadian paradise.
Just like, this place is another world. Anyway, oh my god.
Yeah, I'm actually attempting to write a novel about the Argonauts at the moment, and I'm stuck on Lemnos. So
you're close.
Yeah.
that would be amazing too. I would love a novel about the Argonauts. So
I think it would be fun. The central character is Acastus, so that we get to have in our head the whole time the question of, is he going to be the baddie or not?
Remind me who he is.
He's the son of King Pelias, the one, and in the 1963 film, he's the baddie who betrays Jason.
Right.
So I thought he'd be an interesting character to, and then he has to like make a decision about how he's going to handle all the stuff when they get back to Iolcos.
Yeah. Oh, I like that. Also because like Jason would be really hard to write because he's really boring. I don't know. I guess we can pull that back to the episode itself, which is
my version of Jason is one of these people who's like sort of traumatized by his own beauty.
That feels very Jason. Yeah. Yeah, like taken over by
really bad at making decisions, but also sort of charismatic and caring, and yeah, because I quite like Jason. I want him to be, you know, the not toxic masculinity version, the one who tries hard but just gets everything wrong.
that feels very Jason. Sorry, now I'm trying to pull it back to, because I don't know if you want anything about your novel in the episode, which is...
I don't mind. Okay, I've talked about it quite a few times.
Yeah, okay, cool. Great. Well, because Jason in the various like versions of everything, like I've always kind of had to, you know, pull everything together and form this idea on him. And I obviously, like, you know, part of my show is also comedy, so I'm like a little bit over the top sometimes, and Jason is easy for that.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to me because so many people come to me like, oh, isn't Jason the worst? Like, Jason's the worst hero. And I think Jason is not, like, if we're, you know, if we're collecting the typical heroes, like, who is the, you know, least heroic, maybe?
Yeah.
Like, I do will always stand by Theseus. I have all my various things that I will use as evidence. But in the case of Jason, like, I find him to just be, like, he can't do anything for himself. Like, everything.
Not enough happens. Yeah, Amakinos. He's without resources, like the opposite of Odysseus, Polymakinos.
So there's like a word for it.
yeah. So he does. Yeah, but the thing about Jason is that he's different in every single version. In Pindar, he's actually pretty resourceful and effective and impressive. And maybe that reflected the early tradition. But we don't really know, because Pindar was also trying to make him look good to impress Arcesilaus and get his patrons, you know, to be allowed to go back to Cyrene.
Yeah. Well, so, and it's interesting, and I meant to mention this when you brought it up too. So Jason, in Pindar, Jason actually is the one who has Medea fall in love with him, which it is both to me like kind of and also very not Jason. Like, it is him, him doing something, him actually taking control of the situation in an interesting way.
And the big part of the narrative in Pindar is the confrontation with Peleus and then the confrontation with Aietes. So it's the two bits of the narrative, and then the feats that he gets to do. And it's him who deals with the dragon, not Medea. So it's all, you know, much more positive, strong, heroic Jason in Pindar.
That's really interesting. I like that. I'm glad that Jason gets, you know, another version of himself. I usually focus on Euripides just because Medea is my favorite play.
It's very, very influential.
Yeah.
You've got some really, really negative Jasons, like Henry Treece's 1961 novel, where he is just, I mean, he's worse than in Euripides. He's like incredibly cowardly. Has no redeeming features, is always trying to manipulate people, you know, rapes Atalanta when she's scared. And, you know, there's just loads of, he's just really, really horrendous. And he's the first person narrator. So Treece is playing around with, you know, how evil can he make his narrator, and people will still read the story.
Interesting. I hadn't heard of that. That sounds both dark and fascinating. But yeah, the Herodes version is so interesting because, I mean, obviously it's explicitly like against Jason because that's who is writing these letters. But it's interesting to have these two different people who experienced him in such different ways, like writing about what he did.
And there's some really cool versions of Hypsipyle, particularly the like the medieval tradition where Ovid is super important because they didn't have a lot of the Greek stuff. So, or at least it wasn't well known. And so there's a really cool sort of a romance novel by Lefebvre where there's another woman as well called Miro, who he originally falls in love with.
Oh my God.
And then Hypsipyle seduces him, then Medea seduces him, and then on his way back Hypsipyle sees them and commits suicide. So it's
wow. Yeah, that reminds me, I was recently looking for like an image of her, and there was so many medieval versions and I didn't really realize
really
why
popular. Yeah,
interesting.
And there's a brilliant opera by Cavalli from 1649 called Giassone, which is all just basically dodgy erotic stuff, and if you look on YouTube there's quite a good performance of it, and it's basically soft porn, and at the end of it he ends up with Hypsipyle, not with Medea.
Wow. That kind of thing back then, that feels surprising and impressive.
And basically they spend the whole time on this island doing sort of dodgy romantic subplots and trying to deceive each other and persuade each other to jump off cliffs.
That sounds wonderful.
It was very popular in the 17th century. But it doesn't get performed now because there's sort of no canonical, like, a score for it. So they have to every time someone performs it, they have to sort of reconstruct it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there's so much. Oh my gosh. Okay. That's fascinating.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity. It's designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals to help cover unexpected expenses, plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. In other words, it's like getting a paycheck for life. We'll say that again. A paycheck for life. Guaranteed. Sounds too good to be true? It's not. It's the Parity Flex annuity. And it's one more example of their commitment to creating a better financial future for women. One where they feel empowered, not excluded, and ready to take on whatever their next chapter holds. Gainbridge believes financial flexibility and security are things we all could use more of. At retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Who's with us? Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Please visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
But so maybe the Orpheus.
Oh yeah, Orphicalca Nautica. Yeah.
Yeah. What is, like I said, I haven't read it. I just recently did a series on the Orphic tradition in whatever way that I could in three episodes, which kind of broke my brain a little bit. And so I'm like vaguely familiar now with the tradition itself. But yeah, what is the deal with this Orphic Organautica, which is basically like Orpheus takes almost the role of Jason, right? Like he's like the leader.
Orpheus is the narrator, but okay. he's still there as a sort of, he's the first person who arrives, and he is in Apollonius as well. And he takes a much more important role. So there's a lot more ritual. When they're trying to get the fleece in Colchis, he does lots of ritual activity to make it happen, and he's there when they get the dragon and so on. But and it also misses out all the love stuff, so it basically just skips over it. So, so it's not as different as all that. It's clearly still got a lot of connections with Apollonius. So there's also quite a bit of Valerius Flaccus in it, I think, as well, which I'd like to have fun with, because mostly people assume the Greek traditions don't read the Latin stuff. And I'm not sure that's true. But the fun thing is, the Orphic Arcanautica, you'd think, is a pretty obscure text. Mm-hmm. There's no lurb of it. There's no sort of canonical translation. And there's some slightly dodgy ones that are out there, but there isn't a decent published translation of it yet. So we're, you know, hardly anyone reads it. And yet Charles Kingsley's The Heroes, which was like a really, really popular children's book in the late 19th century. Charles Kingsley picked the Orphic Argonautica to base his Jason and the Golden Fleece on. So it's quite a lot of it is actually a translation of the Orphic Argonautica. And for him, I think he must have done that because he thought it was the earliest version, because he talks about it as what an old tale. So I think he actually believed it was by Orpheus. Whereas actually it's a 5th century AD text. So I think there was some scholarship where they did know that, but he obviously didn't think that.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. Yeah, I mean, all the Orpheus stuff is so, I mean, complex and not complex, but the idea of, yeah, like that he wrote anything or that he was a person. So do they leave out Medea entirely, or is she there like without a romance plot?
She's there, but it's just like summarized super quickly in like three lines.
She's like not concerned with her, really.
No, not really. So, and then Orpheus does a lot of the stuff that Medea would normally do.
Right. You got to give him that. That's really interesting. The Valerius Flaccus, what is that?
I sort of came to the Argonauts through Valerius Flaccus because I did my PhD on Statius, which was written about, which was about the same sort of time, and they share a Hypsipyle episode. So, and Valerius Flaccus was writing at the end of the first century AD under the emperor, either Vespasian, Titus, or Domitian, or maybe all of them. It's very much a Roman Argonautica. So he obviously knows Apollonius really well and plays around with it, but it's actually not very much like Apollonius. It has lots of Virgil in it as well and lots of Ovid. And it's a really cool text. It's really fun. His Medea is actually very, like, virtuous. So it takes her a lot longer to fall in love with Jason. She has an entire book of watching Jason fight battles and being manipulated by Juno and then Venus herself actually, like, going down and making her fall in love. And she resists really hard.
Oh, that's great. That reminds me, I was also recently speaking about Ovid's take on Medea in the Metamorphoses specifically, because
yeah, that's fun too.
It is. I mean, it doesn't really, I mean, it includes Jason obviously, but it's not as much about the Argonautica so much as it is like just Medea flying around in a dragon chariot, like being cool.
I like that, because she's basically taken over the Argonaut journey. So instead of getting the Argonauts, you get Medea flying around in her chariot.
Twice. She gets two trips around in her chariot, seeing everything.
We're viewing it from her point of view, so
yeah, no, it's that's something that's coming out in the episode I have on next Friday, because I spoke with Stephanie McCarter about her new translation of it's very exciting, but there's a lot of Medea and her dragon chariot in there. But it is interesting. I hadn't thought about it in that way, though, where it kind of, like, subsumes the Argonautica. Like, he chooses not to cover the Argonautica. He's like, nah, like, I want to talk about all the weird magic that Medea does. And, yeah, that's quite interesting, especially when you consider the roadies.
And it's rejuvenating. She's rejuvenating the story.
Yeah, that's true. And literally.
And all the different herbs, and her, that sort of version, that Ovidian version, is really influential later on as well. So the 19th century art quite often has images of Medea walking around in forests gathering herbs, which is really Ovidian. It may have come through William Morris, because, you know, William Morris, the arts and crafts movement guy, he actually wrote a complete epic, The Life and Death of Jason, which has got a lot of Ovid in it, as well as lots of medieval stuff.
Wow. I didn't know that either. There's so much. I love that. I mean, of course, because you wrote a book about it. But yeah, all the ways that it has been used later is really interesting. I'll admit, I even only saw the like 1960, is it three movie?
1963, yeah.
I only saw that like last year for the first time, which is bad. And I haven't even seen the Titans one. I don't know why I'm so bad at this, but that one was incredible. Like, I was not expecting. It's hard, you know, like.
The stop motion animation is amazing.
It's incredible. And just the Hydra. Skeleton.
The skeletons. Oh my God, they're so good.
That makes me wish that they were in the book, like this idea of them being.
And
like,
it's skeletons. Funny how after that all the picture books and all the images have skeletons instead of warriors in armor. And
well, it's so, like
up till about 2000 when it starts to tail off, and then you get a sort of more authentic sort of.
Yeah. Well, it makes me think of his Medusa, rather, in Clash of the Titans, becomes like the canonical Medusa. Like, everyone now sees Medusa as this, like, bottom half snake lady.
Dragony tail.
That's not in any bit of Greek myth. Like, that's
Harryhausen are massively influential.
Yes. I mean, because it's beautiful stuff. But, that's
although his Medea is very disappointing. Because she's just basically a dancing girl and she doesn't really get to do anything. So, very James Bond, very Bond girl.
Yeah, he definitely likes Jason more than Jason is actually.
It's a strong 1960s macho Jason with lots of, like, skepticism about the gods. Great score, though. The score by Bernard Herrmann is really good.
And the Talos, I could look like all that. Talos is
amazing.
Yeah, that Talos is in Apollonius's take, right?
Right at the end, the though. Creep. So what Harryhausen, what the scriptwriters have done is to swap it around so that they avoid the Hillas episode, and they have a different way of, a non-sexualized way of getting rid of Hercules.
Right.
And they also and then Medea is not able, you know, it's not her power that deals with Talos, it's Jason. So it's all, you know, carefully fitting things into expectations in the 1960s.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about that bit. Of course, yeah, they're not going to make Heracles leave because he was in love with a man.
Yeah, although there's quite a good dynamic between the two, and Hillas is pretty camp. So I think the subtext is there. It's just they don't want to make it too obvious.
Yeah, yeah. When it comes to like other, like earlier, I guess, like between Pindar and Apollonius, do we have a lot of references? Or rather, I guess, I don't know if that's a fair question.
There's quite a bit of, it's mostly fragmentary. There's a lot of tragic fragments, and there's a lot of mythography in fragments as well. So Pherecydes did there's quite a lot of rationalizing stuff. The idea that the ram was actually a guy called Ram, or the bulls were gods that were Taurian, so hence Tauroi.
Yeah.
So there's a strong rationalizing tradition that goes back to the 5th century.
Interesting.
And there's quite a lot of historians who wrote about it as well, which is then reflected in, say, Diodorus Siculus, who's writing in, I think, 1st century BCE. And his version is totally different. For him, the Argonauts is a sort of subset of Heracles. So Heracles is with them the whole time. And they just help him do stuff. Like, they help him put Priam on the throne in Troy. They help him get rid of Phineas and replace him with someone else. So it's all just a Heracles thing.
Interesting.
So probably there were two traditions. Probably there was a Heracles version and a Jason version, which is quite fun because often in the modern, like, say, young Hercules is Hercules and Jason, and some of the films, like the 1958 Fatigue di Ercole, is also a mashup where Hercules is sort of in charge.
Interesting. I forgot it. I haven't watched Young Hercules since I was young. And now, always want to go back to that, though. I mean, God.
Yeah.
Right. Awesome. Canadian pride. The tragic fragments, how many, like, were there a lot of plays that we think featured these guys?
Quite a lot of different plays, mostly focused on particular episodes. So, like, the killing of Peleus when they get back, there's quite a lot of Iolcos stuff. There's some, there's the root cutters, which is, so that's Peleus's daughters killing him off. There's also quite a few Phineas tragedies. I think all three of the tragedians wrote about Phineas. So Phineas is the guy with the harpies, the prophet. And in Apollonius, he's a good guy, and they're saving him from these horrible harpies who are destroying him. And Apollonius's version has completely sort of overwritten everything else. But when you look at the tragedies, you find that there's a strong alternative tradition in which he was a really nasty piece of work. He had put aside his first wife, who was Cleopatra, the sister of the sons of Boreas, Zetes and Calais. And so she's their sister. He's put her aside, and then he's either killed, imprisoned, or blinded her sons, and taken another wife. And the second wife wanted to get rid of her. So it's he's an evil villain and is being punished with the harpies and with blinding for a really good reason. And then when the sons of Boreas turn up in Apollonius, they rescue him, but they spend quite a lot of time like saying, "You sure we should do this? This seems a bit risky." And in the Orphic Argonautica, they all punish him, and the Argonauts, Boreas blows him off into the wilderness where he dies. So it's a totally different tradition that is basically under the surface. And because Apollonius has dominated all the later versions, Valerius, everything except the Orphic Argonautica. And it's interesting because Kingsley in that point has is really unsure what to do. And there he includes all the versions. So he's just like, there are some that say this and some that say that.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like what I do every time I talk about anything these days.
Yeah.
I can't pick one version. I have to tell you everything. I'm sorry. One of the things that's destroyed me for that, and I realize I'd heard about the root cutters through that, is the Timothy Gantz Greek or early Greek myths.
Oh my God, I love Gantz so much.
So helpful. And also I think that he has definitely caused my podcast to be like a lot more in the weeds than it like necessarily needs to be.
Very good nerdy stuff.
Yes. Yeah, my
so lovely.
That's how I know about Pharocides at all, because it's so fragmentary that like it's really hard to come across any of his stuff outside of that work, I find. But meanwhile, like,
yeah,
so
you have to go to Bob Fowler, which is all still in Greek and not translated, so yeah.
Well, then it's no good for me. Yeah,
actually, but they're pretty good. The Lerb fragments, the Greek tragic fragments in the Lerb, are good now.
Yeah, I need to get more of those also. Gosh, there's I don't know why I didn't consider how many fragmentary, like, tragic pieces there would have been about that, which is interesting. But of course, like, you have Jason and Medea, so, like, why wouldn't there be so many more? One thing, I don't know if it connects as well, and I've been told many times that I need to read it, and I haven't yet. But I'm curious what your thoughts on what is his name? This is me not being good at Rome, but the Roman guy who wrote the tragedy of Medea.
Accius?
No.
Seneca?
Yep.
There were quite a few of them, so that's why I'm a bit confused.
Nope,
Accius is only fragmentary, so we don't have that many. We don't really know how he played it. But Seneca, yeah, Seneca's Medea is fun. And his Medea is a lot... so his Jason is a lot more like an Aeneas figure. He's sort of like driven by obligation and trying his best in difficult circumstances. So he's trying to sort of rehabilitate Jason. There's such a long tradition of trying to rehabilitate Jason. I feel like Apollonius is right out at the edge of the spectrum for most rubbish Jason. And Euripides is most hated Jason. And then everybody who comes later is like, no, Jason was actually okay. Let's try and make him okay, apart from Henry Treece.
Do you think that's a Roman thing, trying to heroize Jason?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely the figure of Aeneas is quite important, because Virgil drew so much on Apollonius. Apollonius was really influential on Virgil's Aeneid, and then people who are a bit iffy about Aeneas are like, okay, he's actually really like Jason. So
yeah.
Like, they're sort of rehabilitating Aeneas by rehabilitating Jason.
Interesting. Yeah, they're definitely very similar, as someone who doesn't care for either of them all that much. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I often like to consider what Rome was doing and why, but usually it comes back to like
fighting
about, yeah, or thinking about how Rome treated a lot of women characters versus Greece.
Well, I don't know, because I mean, Medea is Valerius's Medea, I think, is a strong character.
Well, and I say that, and then Ovid's is as well. Ovid's Medea is pretty great.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I feel like in some ways they're like less monstered, as it were. So you've got the Etruscan model of femininity, which contributed to Roman femininity, which was actually quite independent. And, you know, Roman women could own property and have quite influential roles, and in ways, you know, that go beyond a lot of Greek culture, and and to an extent that's true in the Hellenistic period, because, you know, if you're a really, you know, the power thing trumps the gender thing,
right?
If you've got the wealth and power, that's what really matters, and that's sort of true of Roman women as well. So I feel like they're not made into monsters as much. But obviously it's still an incredibly misogynistic culture.
Yeah, I know. And I'm just also like very biased towards Greece and realize I shouldn't be quite so much. It's just where my interests are. Also, it's like classical.
I might actually be a Latinist, she says.
Yeah, no, fair. It's fair. I talk to a lot of them. It's fine. And I also really don't, even just as you're talking about Hellenistic, I'm like, I also don't dive into the Hellenistic period enough. I need to.
But that's very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's more just like, I mean, it, when it comes to mythology, it is like, I just tend to have, you know, the early sources as my interest point, but I'm also using Timothy Gantz and stuff. So it's getting everything, thankfully.
Yeah, I mean, also, quite often the evidence for the early sources comes from a lot later periods. So in order to understand that evidence, you have to sort of, because there's some really interesting bits of Valerius that, you know, like Hercules deals with the sea monster trying to eat Hesione at Troy. So that's a totally different episode that you mostly don't encounter in the Argonaut story, but it's a big episode in Apollonius. Valerius.
Yeah, I have told that story on the podcast, so I am sure that I've read him and didn't just forgot about it because that was like a year ago now. That's an interesting story that I think, I mean, I guess it was definitely one that he was working on an older tradition, right? Because the idea of heritage is very ancient. Yeah.
The Greek and Roman stuff is just sort of not really, you can't divide it up. It's one big culture that is, because we owe so much of our understanding of Greek traditions to Roman preservations of it. So it's you know, it's just all mixed up together.
Yeah, yeah, in a very satisfying way.
Yeah.
Which leads me to, speaking of older sources that tend to be so helpful for us when we don't have earlier sources, Apollodorus, like how much does he work off of Apollonius versus other sources we might not have?
Interesting. So one of the things I did was to look in my spreadsheet of Argonauts, I looked at how much overlap there was between different catalogues of Argonauts, and they were all different.
And, helpful.
Yeah. And Hyginus had more overlap with Apollonius than Apollodorus did. I think Hyginus was drawing from the tragic traditions. So it's really interesting. Apollodorus is actually quite different from Apollonius.
Interesting.
And I guess he's drawing from some of the prose traditions or maybe some of the other early poems.
I find it interesting. I was just looking at those two writers for another story and the way that they can vary a lot in ways where just leaves like all these open-ended questions about like what they were working off of, because we have these two, like in my case I was looking at the story of Ino of Thebes.
That's an important backstory.
I guess it really relates closely to where the Argonauts plays. But it's interesting because, you know, I'm looking at the Gantz and so much else, and she is not named as like the stepmother villain of the Phrixus and Helle bit until people like Hyginus and Apollodorus, whereas like before that in the sources that we have, it's like an unnamed stepmother, and so it could be like a different Athamas, and it doesn't necessarily need to be Ino, and it's an interesting thing of trying to navigate that. And it's like, okay, well, but those two guys or sources name her as Ino, and like what are they working off of? And
yeah. And like Jason's mom is very confusing as well. She has loads of different names.
Interesting. I realize I don't think I know much about her at all. Like, what are the different versions of who she was?
So I think there are three or four different names. Alcimede is the one that Apollonius uses. And he actually gives her quite a lot of airtime. So they have that whole sort of, because he was taken away as a baby and then just came back. And then she has to let him go again, probably to die. And actually, that mother relationship and the whole emotional thing is big in the 2000 TV version, the Hallmark one.
I can picture that one. I don't know if I've seen it.
It's actually pretty interesting. So it also plays around with, like, it has a bizarre scene where Zeus tries to seduce Medea.
Oh, interesting.
But yeah, and some of the things that at the time I was like, this is just completely out there. I then looked up and found that, you know, there were actually early variants that had stuff like this in there. So I was like, oh, okay. There was me thinking they'd made that bit up, but actually maybe he found it somewhere.
Yeah, like actually maybe they were going so deep into like some wild fragment that they actually like were weirdly accurate. That's interesting. Yeah. That somehow that reminded me, though, they're deeply unrelated. One of my favorite things in looking at the story of Jason is that piece of pottery. I forget what physically it is, but it's the one where Jason's like getting spat out by the dragon.
The Doris cup. Yeah, love yeah. that. So cool. Yes.
It's so cool. And we don't have like an actual surviving source that it describes that happening, right? Like him actually getting eaten and spat up. But we like, I feel like people
have theories.
Yeah.
Mainly Jason Colavito. He has many theories. But yeah, I mean, it could be some version. There are other visual representations with the same thing on it. So it's not only the one. So it seems to be a separate iconographic tradition. And the iconographic traditions and the textual traditions are not always the same. Mm-hmm. So, and it could be some sort of rejuvenation narrative. I think there's some stuff in the tragic fragments in which Medea rejuvenates Jason. And so it could have been some sort of rejuvenation ritual, or it could be like a sort of Jonah and the whale narrative where you get sort of swallowed but come find your way out again. And it's interesting that in the vase, in the Doris cup, it's Athena helping him, not Medea. So there are quite a lot of older versions that don't give much sort of a role to Medea. And it may be that she was a fairly straightforward sort of, I think it's in the catalogue of women where they just get married and everything's happy and fine. And she is presented as being the goal of this quest rather than the fleet. So.
Yeah, that sounds about right. That sounds like Hesiod, if it was Hesiod.
Well, there's also the possibility she was a goddess from that fragment, because it's in amongst a whole bunch of other goddesses that marry mortal men.
Well, interestingly, she technically should be, right? Like, based on her parentage, but she's pretty mortal.
Granddaughter of Helios, so. Mm-hmm. I mean, and Circe is her aunt. So if Circe is a goddess, she could be.
That's the thing.
Her mom is a nymph, apparently.
Right. Yeah, that's the thing. By all of that genealogy, you would think that she was, like, comparatively to anyone else in that situation, and certainly in like most,
hence getting the dragon chariot.
Yes, exactly. Well, she's got it. Yeah, I mean, Helios is going to give her that.
Right here, right now, find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity. It's designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals to help cover unexpected expenses, plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. In other words, it's like getting a paycheck for life. We'll say that again. A paycheck for life. Guaranteed. Sounds too good to be true? It's not. It's the Parity Flex annuity. And it's one more example of their commitment to creating a better financial future for women. One where they feel empowered, not excluded, and ready to take on whatever their next chapter holds. Gainbridge believes financial flexibility and security are things we all could use more of. At retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Who's with us? Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Please visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring? but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
That reminded me. Back when I very first started this podcast, like 5 years ago, when I just honestly really had no idea what I was doing and just like picked up a book of Greek myths that I found. So basically, before I started working off of almost exclusively primary sources, I remember I had read some version in some, like, you know, compendium of modern retelling of Greek myths, where it was described that, like, Medea gave Jason like a poison, I guess, and explicitly told him to get eaten by the dragon so that he could like poison the dragon from within and then get spat out. And that was interesting. It is interesting now thinking about like somebody reconstructing part of the story based on that pottery, but not based on any kind of like textual example, but like also adding in so much. Like that's like fully invention of the idea of like, yeah, well, he's doing it strategically because it's like a poison and this is all going to work out and that's how he's going to defeat the dragon. Like
that is Daniel Ogden's line.
Oh, if he was on my podcast like 2 weeks ago.
That's what he told me he thinks anyway.
Well, then I bet you I definitely wasn't reading him back then, but maybe this person had written, I think it was Robin Waterfield.
Oh, okay.
Which I look back on.
It's probably a theory that's been around for a while because there are quite a lot of rationalizations or explanations of things that have a sort of venerable tradition of their own, like the idea of the clashing rocks being icebergs, which goes back at least, I mean, Kingsley uses it in, you know, 1867 or whatever it was, 1855, actually, I think.
Is there any part of the Mediterranean that would get cold enough for icebergs?
Well, I think if you're going to take that line, it's either that the climate was a lot colder then and they had come all the way down through the Black Sea, or that Colchis is not at the edge of the Black Sea, it's somewhere else, or that the voyage actually involved going a lot further north, which it does in the Orphic Argonautica. So on the return journey, they go either through the English Channel or even further up, you know, around the top of Scandinavia.
Wow.
So they go really far north. And there's also a version where they go really far south as well and find, you know, go around Africa or find the Okeanos and go all the way around the world.
Oh, I love that. That's really interesting. I'd never imagined something going that far. Makes me think of all the people trying to rationalize Atlantis. And is there any kind of, like, I
don't think there's any Argonauts in Atlantis, except for the TV series,
BBC
Atlantis, which has got Jason in it. That is actually very cool. I want to write about that.
I watched a couple of episodes for that for another podcast I was on. I forgot about that. Yeah, that was a wild thing where it's like suddenly all of Jason's things are in Atlantis.
And Pythagoras. Why Pythagoras? Just someone people have heard of, I guess.
That's exactly what I was just going to say. Like, I do think that they just picked the names that were both like somebody people had heard of. And probably in the case of Jason, like, I almost wonder if they were like, well, like, Hercules has been overdone, but like we also want someone whose name is like easy for people to remember. So we're not going to go with like Cadmus or like, I mean, Theseus, I guess maybe you could have, but Jason is just such like it's the one Greek name I think that sounds so completely English in a way that like.
Yeah, I guess that's why why Rick Riordan uses it in the Heroes of Olympus as well.
Does he use
it? He has a Jason,
Yeah.
One of his heroes.
That's interesting. Yeah, I forgot about that Atlantis show. It was like actually I think I watched the whole first season. It was,
I mean, Yeah, I got bored in like the second episode of the second season or something and stopped. I should watch the rest of it though. I liked the mashup of the Theseus myth with the Jason myth, because that, mm-hmm. that actually already happens in Apollonius. So, because he uses Theseus as an example to persuade Medea, and it doesn't work in terms of temporality because
you would have had to be before.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, but that feels to me like what they tried to do with Theseus, which, like, and I don't have any concrete evidence for this, but in my head, Theseus is just so much of like a rewrite to put Athens into all the important things.
Yeah, let's just add Theseus. So I guess Apollonius refusing to have Theseus in the Argonautica is like one in the eye for Athens.
Yeah, because he is also included in the Argonautica in some versions, right? On your spreadsheet?
Yeah, he's in some of the quite early pots. I mean, there's definitely an early pot with the gathering of the Argonauts, which includes Theseus.
Interesting. Yeah. Is it Athenian or Attica?
I think it is Attic, yeah.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Hence all the Athena versions. So, like, the Athena is then the person in charge of everything.
Which connects to the other thing I'd thought and then forgotten. So, thank you. That's the other thing that interests me about the Argonautica and Jason specifically is, like, he is basically the only hero who is helped by someone who isn't Athena, like, who is helped by Hera. Hera doesn't do a lot of helping heroes, and Athena almost explicitly helps. I mean, I think she helps every other hero. Yeah, it's an interesting.
And it is, that's a really early part of the story as well. Mm-hmm. So that's mentioned in Circe's speech, I think. You know, Hera loves Jason. Hmm. So, and that's something they do in the 2000 film. They have a very explicit, like, erotic thing where Hera's trying to wind up Zeus by like going on about how beautiful Jason is, and Zeus is getting angrier and angrier, which they do as sort of thunderstorms erupting.
I have to find that version.
It is actually a lot of fun.
I mean, I can picture the like cover, because like, as someone who was like a preteen in that time, that the actor whose name is also Jason
London. Yeah.
Thank you. He was in like everything. And then now I feel like he's like completely disappeared. But like, I can picture him as like the 2000s actor and then playing that role. Yeah.
And everyone hated him so much. There's some brilliant reviews. There's one like, Jason was like a bowl of soggy cornflakes. And I'm like, yes, this is the Jason I know and love.
That's exactly it. Like, that is Jason. Like, I don't think that's the actor. That is Jason. I had years ago, I had on a guest. We talked about Medea and Jason, and she described him as having the personality of a used dishcloth.
Yep.
Like, I just think that's what makes him him. It's not necessarily an insult all the time. It's just like, that is Jason. He's just kind of like a blank slate.
Well, that's it. That's what I think. I think that every version comes up with their own Jason. So there are also some really powerful dark Jasons as well. There's this really interesting trilogy of fantasy novels by a guy called Robert Holdstock. And his Jason is really violent and sort of compelling and exciting, but vicious and nasty. Mm. And that's quite an interesting one. That's, I think, the darkest Jason.
Interesting. Darker than the other one you're talking about where he's like a rapist too?
Yeah. Well, the Tris one, I think, is more the dishcloth, but with a lot of emphasis on the used.
Gotcha. I see. This is why I can't hate Jason in the way that, like, I do love to hate Theseus. Like, I love that part of it, because I just think it's fun to point out everything that makes him a mess. But when it comes to Jason, like, I just think he is fascinating in the way that he is this blank slate, that he is just kind of like this malleable, like, thing. He is so many different things. He is so usable by the people around him. He's just kind of this like figurehead who's there in name, but then really just like leaves everything up to everyone around him.
Yeah. I think Apollonius is really, he's the key for that. He definitely is. He's made Jason that blank slate.
Yeah, I mean, he, as the, like, you know, earliest...
Undoing epic heroism.
Yeah. So do you think that was intentional?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, he was just that he was like,
I mean, that lovely election scene, it's just so brilliant. The bit where Jason's got everyone together and they're all ready to go and it's all very exciting and he's sort of full of himself and he's just been compared to Apollo. And then he's like, okay, everyone, I think we should decide who's going to lead us, because it needs to be someone who's really good and can speak well, and everybody goes, Heracles. and then he's and Heracles is like, No, I'd be rubbish. You have to go with him. He's the one who called us. it's very much like that bit in the Iliad where Agamemnon tries to motivate everyone and they all try to go home. Yeah, and it's just how rubbish a leader he is. And it's all just gone horribly wrong. It's totally backfired. And it's just massively awkward and embarrassing. And Hercules also comes out as a bit of a twat. So... there's just no good character in there.
Yeah, that's great. I gotta I thought I'd read it so recently, but it's those little details that like I know at the time that I probably last through my reading of it, but
it's just so much of it and it's so rich, and the scholia are also amazing sources for the early versions as well. There was quite a detailed commentary on it, and that's where Gantz gets a lot of his stuff for the early things, for the fragmentary stuff. A lot of them come from the Apollonius Scholia.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. So I think that I did all my Jason episodes before I got those books, because they were my little investment. But what, is there references to kind of what Apollonius is doing, or like what he might have changed from earlier versions that we don't have, or?
Yes. So yeah, that's where we find out about quite a lot of the tragic fragments. So like the Absyrtus episode, for instance, where Jason murders Medea's brother, and all the different versions of that. There are so many of them. That's where some of the tragic fragments come in, because there was, I think it was Aeschylus' version, where they had a feast in the palace in Colchis. And she realized the fleece seems to have been in the palace in this version, which actually happens quite a few times in the later traditions. But she basically uses Aphrodite distracts Aeetes by making him have sex with his wife. And that's how they managed to get out of the palace. And she brings the fleece with her, and also her tiny little baby brother. Yeah. She then cuts into pieces to put off the hunt. So that's where it's
one of the best.
The Medea child killer thing starts.
Yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned Jason doing it. So is there times when it's Jason who kills Absyrtus and not
In Apollonius, it's Jason who kills him.
Oh, okay.
So, but he's in that version, he's much older and he's leading the pursuit. And he's, it's almost it's not exactly a fair fight because it's an ambush and Medea lures him there. But he is trying to attack Jason and Jason is trying to attack him. And it's all a lot less problematic. It's still quite problematic. And there's this bizarre Maskalismos ritual where Jason cuts off all the extremities of his body to try and get rid of the pollution and not be pursued by his ghost, which is like one of the most interesting bits of evidence for Greek purification rituals.
Ooh. So this is the problem with having read so many different versions. They all blur together in my head. So all I could picture is the Medea doing it. But as soon as you started talking about it, I was like, I now fully remember the getting lured there and it being an actual kind of fight between them. So the purification rituals, does that suggest that it was ever a common thing to cut somebody up into a bunch of pieces so they didn't, your ghost didn't pursue them, or no?
Maybe. I mean, I mean, there's quite a lot of interesting purification rituals in the Argonaut tradition. And so I was working on, there's also the Kyzicus episode. Do you remember that one? The one where where the Argonauts get blown back to the island where they've had, they've made friends with the king, and then they accidentally end up fighting and killing them and everyone dies. Right.
Yeah.
That one. Well, in Valerius, they try to purify themselves. So in Apollonius, they purify themselves by making a big statue of Cybele and, doing rituals for Cybele. In Valerius, they make statues of the dead people and try to persuade the ghosts to go into the wooden statues of the dead people, which they're called colossi, and they're really weird and cool. So there's that, and this the dark fantasy guy, Robert Holdstock, he takes those and then he turns it into this thing where Jason resurrects his Argonauts, who through these wooden figures that they gave him, which then is a way of taking them out of their previous lives, like an episode of depression.
Wow.
These rituals. I mean, just the way that I think a lot of the interest in ritual in the Argonaut myth, in the modern reception of it, comes from Robert Graves, who was absolutely obsessed with it.
I also used to go to Graves more before I kind of realized how much he just seems to have kind
Make
of invented.
Yeah. Make it up.
Yeah.
Oh my God, Robert Graves is so annoying. I hate him so much.
The worst is, like, it's just so hard. As somebody who came to this, like, I have a degree, but I hadn't, you know, studied it. I only have a BA, and, like, I hadn't studied it in, like, 5 years by the time that I started the podcast. And I also just started very casually of being like, I'm just going to, like, read these myths and tell them to people. And then it exploded. And thankfully, like, I also have a keen interest and obsession with making sure that I am, like, doing it, you know, accurately in the way that myth can be accurate. Like, here are the ancient sources. Yeah. Here is what all the different versions are, blah, blah, blah.
But authentically.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like, I am looking at the ancient world. But it took me so much, like, trial and error of, like, oh, I'm going to look at Graves because, look, his book is everywhere. And it seems like he's making all these points.
Literary authors really love him. So, you know, these really posh, well-respected people who think, I'll do a bit of Greek mythology, they go straight to Graves. There's still a real reliance on it.
Yeah.
Needs a good debunking.
The problem is like book sales too, right? Like, it's in public domain, so anyone can do it. And it just, like, I assume it is, or else they just, a bunch of publishers just have all the rights.
They're still reissuing it.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I have, yeah, I was wondering, yeah, because I have this, like, beautiful one. Which is for the listeners, the one of the one where it looks like a comic book, but also people are often really disappointed when they open it and there's literally not, like, it's not like they made it into a comic book. They just made a beautiful, like, comic book cover, which is great. And, like, I have friends who work at Penguin because I used to. And so one of my friends just sent that to me once where she was like, look at this. And I was like, thanks. But it was, again, before I knew that, like, don't look at Graves. Like,
well, I mean, he is interesting because he's got this obsession with like female power and women, you know, like, and the whole of his retelling of the Golden Fleece was before he wrote the Greek myths. So it's sort of how he got into it all. Mm. And he starts off with this theory about the great mother goddess, the triple mother goddess, who is replaced by the Olympians, and then that the whole thing is about a conflict between the mother goddess and the Olympians all the way through. So he's got this obsession with mother goddess power, which is very attractive to sort of goddess worship communities. But at the same time, he's still really misogynist in all sorts of ways, objectifies and sexualizes women. So it's really bizarre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I suppose, I mean, like, I don't use it now for sourcing, but it is certainly interesting to, like, kind of look at what his thought process was too, because, like, he clearly thought a lot about everything that he was writing. It's just a matter of, like, how much he also then invented or just, like, made these sort of wild connections that he then describes almost as fact, kind of.
He will say Hesiod clearly got this wrong. The version in my novel is correct.
Right, you're like, that's rational, yeah. That's with that.
And it's clear that he, on some level, he believed his fiction.
Yeah,
and a lot of people do that conviction, which is sort of mad. It does actually affect people.
Yeah, I struggle with it exactly the opposite. Like, I can't. My biggest struggle with writing my novel is that, like, I have so much trouble inventing myth because I am now so obsessed with sticking to the ancient sources that, like, I've even picked characters that, like, there's very little story about them and like, and then I've picked Samothrace, where there's very little about this island, and I'm still like, I can't invent it. I need to find it in the ancient sources, but like, it doesn't exist. Yeah,
but there are so many different ancient sources that you can just pick amongst them. So
oh yeah, no, and I do, thankfully. Like, I've got a very invented world where I also have had to read some of Nonus, because he's like the only person who ever...
I love Nonus. Nonus is great.
The first person who's ever said that. Every time I mention how much Nonus I've read, people are just like, oh, you're brave. Like that.
When I wrote my Epic Gaze book, I had Quintus of Smyrna in there because I had to review about Quintus of Smyrna. And I was like, oh, this is fun. So I'll put some of that in. And it came back with a reader's report. And the reader's report was like, if you're including Quintus, you should definitely have Nonus. And I was like, oh, Nonus. And then I started reading it. And I was like, wow, Nonus. Nonus is so cool.
Yeah, I love it. He's got such fascinating stuff. I mean, specifically, he's the only author I've ever found to devote really almost any time to anything happening on Samothrace. And he devotes a lot of it. There's like three books on Samothrace with Cadmus and Harmonia. And so like, it's been huge as a source for me.
Theban stuff, any Theban stuff. He just loves that.
Exactly. Which is all I need, because everything else is super fragmentary or plays that none of them talk about Cadmus or like enough, you know. I'm not counting Bacchae. That's not the character that I need.
It's not very helpful. Yeah.
No, it's not my Cadmus. But yeah, no, it's interesting. I love Nonus. I have not read all of it because it is the longest thing ever.
48 books.
Long. But I've definitely read all the Theban stuff or all the Cadmus and Harmonia stuff. And also like his take on Dionysus and Ampelus.
Oh yeah, another... Ampelus, yeah. Yeah. The grape, yeah. Grape boy.
Yes, which like is such like a two-line thing. It's gorgeous in his, and it's like two lines in every other source. It's like, this thing happened, and you're like, thanks, that's super helpful, thank you. And then Nonus is like, let me tell you this like epic beautiful little love story about these cute guys, and like, yeah. Oh, it's so fun. Oh, I'm glad somebody else has even read it, let alone likes it.
Oh, you should talk to my colleague Emily. She's a specialist in late Greek epic.
Oh my gosh, I might talk about that or bring that up later. Okay, well, I feel like we've gone on to so many different topics because this is just fun. I love talking about ancient sourcing broadly. Before I keep you for too much longer, is there any other like, I don't know, fun weird things we should know about the Argonautica? Your favorite details, or I don't know, sometimes it's hard being put on the spot, but
yeah, I don't know. I mean, my favorite version at the moment is a new one I've just discovered, which is a science fiction novel by Samuel Delaney from 1969 called Nova, which is sort of passes itself off as a quest, Grail quest, but is actually definitely got so many Argonaut features. So I'm really excited about that because it's a black authored version and there are not that many. So that's really great. But that's not other cool things about Apollonius. My brain has gone blank.
No, that's a very specific question. I just like to make sure I didn't like stop anyone from sharing the like most exciting thing they love. Well, why don't you, do you want to tell my listeners a bit about your book about this? Because obviously that's why you have so much knowledge.
Yes. So I wrote a book called In Search of the Argonauts, which is out with Bloomsbury. And it basically goes through the story of the Argonauts and then also looks at all the different versions right up to the present day. And it's sort of looks at it in a thematic way. And we look at gender and sexuality and ethnicity and otherness. And we sort of I try to think about the way, you know, the ways people are interested in the meaning of the Argonaut myth and the sort of fascination with, you know, acquisitiveness and the associations with the gold rush and all of, so there's that idea of exploration and it's used by science and all these different versions of the Argonaut story and what it can do in different cultural contexts. So I had a lot of fun with that. I don't know what else to say about it other than that, really.
That sounds great. It also led me to, and I just really quickly, I'd love to hear your thoughts because I realize this didn't come up, but one of the things that I always find so interesting and like to emphasize to my listeners is Medea being othered and like being this person from the East, like a quote unquote barbarian. And I'm not totally, I don't recall quite how much it comes into play in Apollonius. I just think about it in terms of Medea broadly. Yeah. But yeah, like, do you have any thoughts on that?
So, I mean, there's a theory that Argos, son of Phrixus, when they're deciding how to come back, mentions this idea that the Colchians were actually founded by Sesostris from Egypt. And so there's a tradition of the Colchians being black, which does give quite a different, and Krista Wolfe in her Medea, for instance, has Medea as black. And so, yeah, thinking about the different races around the Black Sea and the different tribes, there's a lot going on there where I say Apollonius, for instance, is showing how, you know, Greeks react to different cultures. And then Valerius has got a sort of different take on it because he's got actual experience, you know, the Romans had actual experience of going to amongst the Black Sea people. So he has a lot of fun representing all of them. But yeah, and there's also quite a lot of interest in the idea of a sort of a Black Colchian and of Medea as a sort of refugee or a... and that's there also in Diodorus where she escapes from, she's not interested in Jason. She's not in love with Jason. She just uses Jason to escape from her dad who is busy trying to kill off too many people.
I forgot about that piece from Diodorus. That's where he has this whole wild thing about like Hecate is her mother. Hecate.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And yeah. And then between Hecate and Aeetes, they're like murdering people for fun and like testing poisons on them and and then Medea wants to get away from them. I forgot about that. I love that.
It's great, isn't it?
Yes. I realize I've covered it on like episodes where I talk about witches because it is such like an explicitly like dark version of like Greek witches.
Except that Medea is not dark in this one.
Yeah. It's like it makes Hecate very like much darker than she appears in the ancient Greek sources or like the earlier sources versus Medea, who is more evil in like Euripides, obviously. So like in an earlier Greek source and sort of turns that on its head. Yeah.
Whereas Krista Wolfe turns her into a medic. So she's escaped. She's leading her migrant community and then she's trying to make everyone better and happier. And it's a really like positive and like sort of rehabilitation of Medea.
Yeah, I mean, I love Medea. I think she deserves to be rehabilitated. I definitely have spent way too much time justifying how I don't support it, I understand why she had to kill her children in Euripides. Like, I think he makes a valid point for why she felt it was necessary. Anyway. Yeah. I'm very pro Medea all around. I could probably keep talking about the otherness for ages, so I wish it'd come up earlier, but I won't keep you longer. But I'm glad it came up. Is there anything else you want to share with my listeners in terms of like where they can find more or if they want, you want them to follow you anywhere or whatnot?
I'm on Twitter as Helen Lovett too. I've got an Instagram as well. I do sometimes write about Argonauts in blog Argonauts and Emperors. And I'm hoping I'm going to write more Argonaut stuff in the future. So look out for it. And the book is available from Bloomsbury. And I think that's it.
Wonderful. Well, I'll include some links in the episode's description so everyone can find it. And I realized today that I don't own your book. I just knew all about it. So I'm going to have to go pick up one too, because that sounds fascinating. And now I need to talk more about the Argonauts on the show. This is what happens every time I talk to anyone. I was like, well, okay, now I have a bazillion more topics to talk about on the show. Thank you so much for doing this. It was so much fun.
Brilliant. I've really enjoyed it.
Oh, nerds, nerds, nerds. As always, thank you so much for listening. Gods, I love these conversation episodes. And it's nice to have one like this that is so explicitly myth. I'm always here for the history and the culture, but, I mean, who doesn't love to learn about all the intricacies of a myth like this one? It was so much fun speaking with Helen about it. Such a joy to record. We did actually talk all the way back in October. I'd recorded so many conversations that I even still have a few from back then. There's just too many amazing people who are willing to nerd out with me. It's the best. Anyway, you can learn more about all the versions of the Argonautica through Helen's book, In Search of the Argonauts. I've linked to it in this episode's description, along with her Twitter if you want to follow. God, these conversations are so much fun. The Argo, a bunch of heroes jammed on a boat together. What fun they must have had. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Michaela Smith is the Hermes to my Olympians, handles so many podcast-related things, from running the YouTube to creating promotional images and videos to editing and research. Stephanie Foley works to transcribe the podcast for YouTube captions and accessibility. The podcast is hosted and monetized by iHeartMedia. Help me continue bringing you the world of Greek mythology and the ancient Mediterranean by becoming a patron, where you'll get bonus episodes and more. Visit patreon.com/mythsbaby or click the link in this episode's description. Thank you all for listening. You're cool and nice. I am Liv and I love this shit.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RiteRug.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity. It's designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals to help cover unexpected expenses, plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. In other words, it's like getting a paycheck for life. We'll say that again. A paycheck for life. Guaranteed. Sounds too good to be true? It's not. It's the Parity Flex annuity. And it's one more example of their commitment to creating a better financial future for women. One where they feel empowered, not excluded, and ready to take on whatever their next chapter holds. Gainbridge believes financial flexibility and security are things we all could use more of. At retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Who's with us? Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Please visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.